Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. This is 103.2 Dublin City FM with live streaming on dublincityfm.ie. Inside Education is your weekly mix of news, interviews, stories and features from the world of education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can join me. If you want to suggest a topic for the programme or to comment on an issue, you can email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation, all one word, at dublincityfm.ie. You can text the programme at 086 8962 665. That text number again for your comments or suggestions is 086 8962 665. We have a new website for the programme which makes it easier for you to comment on programmes or to download podcasts of previous programmes. But the address remains the same. That is www.insideed.com. That website address again is www.insideed.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. Barry Hennessy, our weekly news reporter, is not here this evening with us, but he will be appearing on Good Morning Dublin here on this station on Tuesday morning to provide coverage and analysis of the day of protest organised by the public sector unions, including the teaching unions. On to this evening's programme. We have an American feel about the programme this evening. Later on, I will be speaking to educational reformer, writer and activist Deborah Meyer from the United States about the legacy of another educational reformer, Ted Sizer, who died recently. But first, can you tell what the following people have in common? Fergus Finlay, Miles Dungan, Don Thornhill, Father Tom Stack, Professor William Revel, Therese Fahy and Maeve Martin. The answer is that they have all studied in universities in the United States as part of the Fulbright programme. The next deadline for applying for the Fulbright scheme is December the 4th, so I thought that we would find out some more about the scheme this week. Marianne Doyle is the Communications and Information Officer with the Fulbright Commission. I met up with her recently to talk about the Fulbright scheme. I began by asking her, what is Fulbright?
Fulbright is one of the biggest, most important international exchange programmes that the world has ever seen. It was founded directly after the Second World War in 1946 by Senator Fulbright, who was a Democratic senator from Arkansas. And he, in the wake of the Second World War, came up with a system of allowing scholars and future leaders and professionals and students to travel to different parts of the world in order to be able to experience different cultures, and conversely allow people from other countries to travel into the States.
And what are the benefits of getting a Fulbright scholarship?
Well, the benefits are huge. If you walk into, let's say you're an academic and you walk into a campus in the United States, you say you're a Fulbright scholar and the doors open to you, the world is open to you. Apart from the prestige of the program, and it is one of the most prestigious international scholarship funds available, there are also monetary values. For scholars, we offer a travel and relocation bursary of about 10,000. For students, that's somebody who has yet to do their PhD, that would be up to 20,000. We also offer professional scholarships as well, for up to 70,000 in certain disciplines. We organise the visa for people who want to travel to the States, and for Americans who want to come to Ireland, we will manage all their work permit issues, their PRSI and any other HR expenses.
So for somebody who already has a degree but who wants to do a master's or a doctorate, they would get up to 10,000. Is it euro or dollars?
It's euro, and no, for somebody who has yet to do a PhD, they are a student, so it's up to 20,000. 20,000 euro for somebody who has yet to do a PhD.
And what can they use this money for, Marianne?
They can use it for any aspect of their study in the States. We don't ask for receipts back, but it is used for their scholarship while they're in the US. So it can be used for relocation, books, computers, to pay part of their fees. So any of the aspects of the expenses that they incur in the States.
And fees can be quite expensive in the States.
A Fulbright scholarship, in all honesty, will not cover the entire sticker price, the price of the course that you will see in the prospectus. However, there are many different ways that you can, sort of get around this as well and reduce that price. Everybody applying to university in the state should also apply for financial aid. They should also apply for a number of other bursaries that are available from the university. If they contact the Fulbright office, we'll be able to advise them of other opportunities for funding that are available at the university that they want to go to.
And what universities in the United States can people attend?
Any universities. We have a big Bible of universities, accredited universities, over in the United States, and people can go to any of those. You can go to private colleges, public colleges, universities. Also, if you want to do some research in two-year community colleges, that's allowable under the Fulbright. We have a policy of diversity, so we do not discriminate against, nor do we discriminate for any institution. So you're open to go to any of the accredited institutions for lecturing, to research, to take a thought course over in the United States.
So if somebody is interested in applying for a Fulbright scholarship and is listening to this, what do they need in order to be eligible to apply?
Well, we look at the whole individual. So you need to have, in the first instance, academic excellence. So you do need to have a good academic track record. We prefer a 2-1 in a primary degree. However, if it's a 2-2 with a lot of other, you know, kind of accolades or extracurricular activities as well, they should also apply to us. We would also like to see personal excellence. This means somebody who really is committed to their studies, but also to society, people who are going to act as very good ambassadors for their country when they go to the United States. And that's very important, that they are very open, to the culture of the United States, that they'll bring that back to Ireland, and then conversely, that they are able to convey, a sense of who they are and where they come from when they go over there, in order to be able to facilitate this mutual cultural exchange that we promote.
So it's like as if you also value extracurricular activities that people might have been engaged in.
Absolutely, and that's something that people should bear in mind when they're writing their application for the Fulbright programme, which is available on our website. They should focus, yes, on their academic achievements, and that is very important, but they shouldn't forget as well that they need to put themselves forward in other ways as well. If they were captains of debating teams, if they did a lot of volunteer work, if they're involved in charity work, if they help promote international festivals in their college, if they faced adverse circumstances and overcame them in their own personal life, this should show through as well in their application. So we look at the whole individual and the impact that they will make in the States and then when they come back to Ireland again.
And I wonder, Marianne, can you just take us through the application process and what that involves?
Absolutely. So let's say you're applying for the Fulbright Scholarship. First of all, I'm going to say something very important, and that's the closing date is noon on the 4th of December. So people hoping to apply should do that very, very soon. So you'd log on to her website, www.fulbright.ie. When you come to our homepage, you'll see a number of different awards that are open: student awards, scholar award, and then some specialist awards. They need to determine which award they are applying to. They can do that either by reading the guidelines or by giving our office a call, and our contact details are on the website as well. When they open that up, there are a number of questions that they need to fill in. They will have a statement of purpose. This is telling people what they want to do when they're in the States. That's an essay question, and there's also a personal statement. The personal statement, as I was saying earlier, is very important in that you need to show through who you are.
Something you can write off the top of your head.
This absolutely is not.
Yeah.
Remember, for people who on the other side of the Atlantic in the States hoping to come to Ireland, personal statements are, sort of a matter of course. They're things that you do all throughout high school and for your applications into your undergraduate and into your postgraduate, so they may take some practice for people. There are a number of resources available. Be careful if people are researching on the internet for their statements, because, they're not always of the highest quality.
And it needs to be personal, right?
It needs to be personal. There needs to be a narrative showing through. It is about you. Personal really is the apt, word there. They also need to be extremely well written. It is an essay question. So things like punctuation, grammar, use of English, and the fact that there would be a clear voice showing through, a clear person voice showing through the personal statement is very important. I don't think we have enough time to really kind of, go into to what it is, but but there are a number of resources out there, and our office is able to give extra advice as well.
Now, candidates are also required to provide a reference. Who should candidates ask to write a reference for them?
Yeah, they'll need to provide three references, and ideally they should go to people who know them in a personal capacity, and who know them possibly in an academic or professional capacity, but people who know them personally. People who are able to write, kind of with authority about the type of person that they are.
So when you get in all the applications then, Marianne, what criteria do you use to select successful candidates?
Well, as I was saying there, I mean, your academic excellence is definitely important, that you have, applied yourself in your previous studies and that you will apply yourself in future studies. This isn't an official term, but it's one that I like to use, the multiplier effect, that you will be able to influence people. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be on the television every day, but if you're going to become, if you're going to be a teacher, that you're able to influence your students. You maybe, will write books, will write articles, or will influence your circle of friends and your family about the cultural exchange that you've had. Then we also want to see that that you're a well-rounded person. The extracurricular activities are very important, and also that you have a firm sense of what you'd like to achieve, your outcomes when you're in the US, and then when you come back to Ireland, that you have researched your options, that you have a firm sense of who you are and what you're going to do.
And if you're successful, does Fulbright find you a place in a university in the United States?
No, most of the programmes, as in we call them the All Disciplines Awards for Students and Scholars, you find your own place. So say if you are a student, you're finishing your undergrad at the moment and you'd like to go to the States to do a master's course, you would apply to your master's courses over in the States at the same time as you're applying for your Fulbright Award. Now, the choice that you have over in the US as regards courses you can do is absolutely phenomenal. So you really do need to narrow those down to about five different universities. We have an educational advisor in the Fulbright Commission, and there's also an educational advisor in the US Embassy in Dublin. You should also visit your Career Guidance Centre and talk to your professors, talk to your peers. And likewise, if you're an academic and you're hoping to lecture in research over in the States, if you don't have contact through the strategic links that you have with your international office and with universities in the States, you also need to be able to get a letter of affiliation to allow you to teach and to lecture or to research within an institution in the States. Again, we have advice on how you do that as well if you contact the office.
So really there are two applications that need to be made here. One is to Fulbright and the other is to institutions in the United States.
That's it. Now, we do have programs, for example, our Irish Language Awards. Unfortunately, that deadline has closed by now.
For this year.
It is open next year. So there are some courses, awards that you do, that we will help you find an institution that will actually place you in an institution. But for the general awards that are closing now on December 4th, you do need to find your own affiliation.
And what is the experience of being a Fulbright scholar like? I spoke to one alumnus.
I was awarded my Fulbright in 2000 for studies in America, and initially it was for a 1 year period, but I extended my studies until the end of 2002. I was studying cello in Indiana University, which is one of the largest music schools in America. It had something like 1,500 music students, which is quite large in terms of even American colleges. So I was there for 2 years studying performance, and I did my postgraduate studies there, and then I came back to Ireland.
That is Gerald Peregrine. Gerald has been steeped in music since he was 3 years old. That's not surprising, really, because he comes from a musical family. Among his relations are household names Geraldine O'Grady, Des Keogh, Nat Cossadig, and the late Frank Patterson. Gerald's Fulbright experience was a positive one.
It opened up a lot of opportunities. It provided me with the chance to study at a large university. It exposed me to a very high level of study and a very high level of competition. It exposed me also to the American university system and the American educational attitude, which is very progressive and very forward, sometimes in contrast with the Irish way of doing things. And it provided me with the confidence to try new projects and develop my profession when I came home.
Although Gerald had done his undergraduate degree in London, he found the US experience to be quite different.
The American school was is very inclusive in a way. There was a lot of opportunities for all students, and although the competition was as high as in London, there were a lot of chances to hone your skills, and there was a lot of emphasis on self-motivation. And
the United States also offers opportunities that would not be available in Ireland.
I suppose there's just it's just everything is done on a larger scale. There's a lot more investment from individuals rather than from governments, and there's a lot more patronage of the arts, and it's a very positive attitude towards music and the arts, and the arts are regarded very highly over there, and that's something which obviously as an artist I value, and I want to bring back to Ireland that understanding and respect for the arts.
And what would Gerald say to someone considering applying for a Fulbright scholarship in music or in another discipline?
I'd have to say go for it. It's definitely been an important part of my resume since I was awarded the scholarship, and I valued my time very much in the States, and it was an educational experience on all levels, and made a lot of good friends, and definitely honed my skills, and I wouldn't have swapped it for the world. I think if you have a chance to go for it, you should.
And even after his Fulbright experience, Gerald has made contacts within the Fulbright community.
But since I've come back to Ireland, I've been working with fellow Fulbrighters within the music profession. I have a new duo with the pianist Cathal Breslin, who is also a Fulbrighter, and we've come together to work now and to collaborate. And I have worked in other projects with fellow Fulbrighters who've returned to Ireland. So there is a sense of community within the music scene of Fulbrighters, and we've all returned home to Ireland with our knowledge.
And Gerald is a member of the Piano Trio Ensemble Avalon, and he will be performing at the Winter Chamber Festival in Wexford on the 5th and 6th of December. The two pieces of music you heard are from his CD entitled Heavenly. You can find out more at his website, which is www.geraldperegrine.com. And I will have a link to that from the programme website. The Fulbright website is www.fulbright.ie. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. To get in touch with the programme, you can text 086 8962 665. That text number again is 086 8962 665 for your comments and suggestions. The name of Ted Sizer may be unfamiliar to many teachers in Ireland, but it would be hard to find an educator in the United States who hadn't heard of him. He was born in 1932, graduated in English from Yale in 1953, and he joined the army. He graduated in English from Yale in 1953, and then he subsequently joined the army. Between 1955 and 1961, he taught in the United States and in Australia, and completed a master's and PhD in Harvard University. He taught in Harvard from 1961 and became Dean of the School of Education in 1964, aged only 32. In 1972, he resigned as Dean to become headmaster of a school in a position he held for 9 years. Since then, he did a study of high schools, which led to the widely acclaimed book Horace's Compromise in 1984. Since then, he has worked to reform American high schools and has also worked as a professor at Brown University and at Harvard. Sadly, he passed away as a result of colon cancer on October the 21st this year. In order to tell us more about Ted Sizer, I'm joined by Deborah Meyer on the phone. Deborah is a former kindergarten teacher who founded a network of highly successful elementary schools in East Harlem in New York City. She is currently a senior scholar at New York University's Steinhardt School of Education. You're welcome to the programme, Deborah.
Hello, nice to be here.
Deborah, how did you first get to know Ted Sizer?
Well, I, after starting these wonderful elementary schools in East Harlem, we talked to kids who went on to high school, and everybody kept saying that the last time they really enjoyed school and thought they learned a lot was when they had been with us in elementary school. So they said, why don't we have a secondary school? And I thought the idea was wonderful, but I figured I really didn't know a lot about secondary school education, and if we tried to start a secondary school, we would be met with a lot of hostility because we really did things the way we had from kindergarten through sixth grade, that we would run into problems with the state and the regulations.
In getting approval and so on.
Getting approved, having to pass lots of hoops that you could sort of, we thought, get away with in the elementary school, avoiding. And then I read an article in a newspaper called Education Week, which had an excerpt from a new book that was, they said, about to come out by Ted Sizer. And I read this, and I thought, ah, a high school man and a Harvard man with all these high credentials, and he talks about secondary school the way I talk about kindergarten through sixth grade. And so I thought, oh, if I could get hold of him, maybe he could be sort of our front cover. I don't know what you would call it in Ireland.
Front.
For persuading people that they should take a chance on us. And I called a friend who called a friend who knew a friend who knew might know Ted Sizer. And when he heard the message, he said, well, why doesn't she just call him? Call me, he said. And that's so typical of Ted. He answered his own phone calls. He answered his email. And I did. I called him, and before I knew it, he was in New York, and his book had just come out, and he was looking for schools to represent his ideas, and I was looking for ideas for what a secondary school could look like that kept our tradition going. And he turned out not to be just a good cover for a non-mainstream idea, but also to be brilliant in his way of thinking about schooling, insightful in from details to big ideas, and perhaps even more important, to be the most respectful human being who was able to touch people from very different backgrounds and expectations and traditions. You know, it would take five people of his intellectual strength to be as powerful a voice as he was, because most of us speak especially strongly when we're talking to teachers or parents or policymakers, but we have a hard time making the same speech that reaches all of them at once.
And Deborah, how would you sum up his vision of education and what education should be about?
Well, in the broadest, abstractest sense, it was about the kind of ways young people use their minds that is compatible with a humanistic and democratic tradition. And that's in the huge way. But he brought it down to kind of details that school people could understand. You have to have a clear purpose, using the mind well, and that all young people needed to use their mind to the fullest. And then he reminded us that you can't do that if you don't know each kid well, that no two young people are the same, not whether they're two-year-olds or 20-year-olds or 80-year-olds. They are different, and the way they learn has to take that into account, both their interests, their style. You have to be listening to the learner in order to teach the learner.
And he thought that that was difficult because of the teaching load that teachers had in terms of the frequency of class changes and because of the large number of students that teachers were responsible for.
The average American high school teacher sees 150 students a day in class, you know, in five classes of 30 each, sometimes larger. And that there is no time for colleagues to get together to really think about their work. There's no time for a student to meet with a teacher. There's no time in the class itself to remember whose name is what, much less how they think about.
But he went beyond the criticizing the system as it was, and he set up what he called the Coalition of Essential Schools.
He developed nine essential aspects that he thought would meet, that a school needed to meet, and they were all of one part, and they all had to do with knowing students well and teaching them to use their minds well. So there was sort of nine principles: less is more, that it's better to cover something deeply than everything shallowly, that it, respect and high expectations have to go together. In any case, they were and he had a way of looking at schooling that didn't look for blame, except that we had set up a structure as though we didn't care whether kids learned to use their minds well. And that structure was frustrating everybody, parents, students, society, and teachers.
Deborah, what do you think will be his most enduring legacy to education in the United States?
It's hard to know, because part of it is so, for me, is so tied up with that unshakable optimism and respect he has for every, you know, you can't really disappoint him.
he was always smiling.
Yes, and that special kind of very, almost mischievous smile. I mean, it wasn't a smile out of naivete, but a kind of intrigue. He was interested in your mind. He was interested in your experience. Didn't you find that when you met with him?
I did indeed. And I think mischievous is actually a very good word.
It wasn't that he wasn't critical, and by any means, he just was, his criticalness was honed around the question, if I could understand this argument better, it will expand my understanding about what we need to do. And therefore, and also that I respect, trust everybody I talk to. He starts off with that premise of trust, that everyone is trying their best. And if you could sometimes argue to him about why maybe they weren't, and he said, well, I can't have a conversation, a thoughtful conversation, if I don't start off that way. And it turns out that taking that stance, which I think was so deep within him that he couldn't have done anything else.
And it applied...
That's the essence of a good teacher in a good school, that it takes every kid's thoughts seriously. And it wins kids over by taking them for what they... seriously. Taking their ideas, even if you think they're just teasing you or gaming the system, that is as important as anything else.
Finally, Deborah, when I met Ted Sizer, I had the really good fortune to meet him 10 years ago, and at the time he spoke to me about you, and he said that you are someone who reads, thinks deeply, teaches, and takes the time to write. And he went on to say that it's a superhuman effort, and it should be just human. So just to finish up, what projects are you yourself currently engaged in?
Well, I, after starting lots of schools and coming up with ideas for how we could have a larger effect and the coalition and all that, I'm still involved in all of that. I still have close ties to all the schools that I was involved in founding and a lot of other schools that I've run into since. I speak and I write. My connection with NYU is mostly so I can have an office, and it's an opportunity to contact and stay alive with other colleagues and occasionally to teach a course. But I'm mostly concerned these days with thinking of how we can use our voices as teachers to influence the people who are making policy in this country and the people who are influencing those policymakers, I think unwisely.
Deborah, I'm so sorry we have to leave it there, because I think we could talk a lot longer, but thank you very much for joining me on the phone this evening.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for thinking about Ted Sizer.
Thank you indeed.
For devoting the time to that. I hope everybody goes and looks.
And I will put links to his websites, by the Coalition of Essential Schools, yes, and to your own website.
Morris's Compromise could be read 100 times.
I totally agree.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Deborah. And our thoughts are with Ted's wife, Nancy, and his family at this time. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. If you have comments or suggestions for the programme, you can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. And the programme's website again is insideed.com. Thanks to this evening's guests, Marianne Doyle, Gerald Peregrine and Deborah Meyer. Instead of the usual theme music this evening, I'm going to leave you with another piece from Gerald Peregrine's CD, Heavenly. This track is Black Orpheus. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.